Hi and welcome to Attention Please, episode 47 on the Talking Stuff Network. I am Vikram Mohan. We are recording this on the day of the finals in London, like we talked about last week. And this is one I'm really looking forward to. But I was hoping that at least one of the two sides was different. But the Federer versus Nadal semi was also great. And today's final with Djokovic promises to be thrilling as well. But Arnab is going to talk about the other final. The one I suspect that many of us are trying very hard to forget. It still hurts, mind you. But our host isn't here to gnaw the raw wound at, make us feel bad, but rather give us his diagnostic from a cricket management perspective. So here to provide his diagnosis is Dr. Arnab Ray. Arnab, you've got a doctorate. So do you like being addressed as Dr. Ray, or does it sound odd?
Well, it depends on the context. So in this context where my being a PhD has nothing to do with what I'm going to say, it kind of sounds mocking because it has got nothing, because then the doctor is essentially a way of saying this person is extremely pedantic, because the doctorate has absolutely nothing to do. But of course, in a conference when I'm going to talk about cybersecurity or computer science, yes, that's relevant then, because then at least that gives some weight to what I'm going to say. But otherwise, no, I actually don't like... But this is a good thing, because, you know, one of the things that I... normally, you don't mention the word doctor unless you're in a place where nobody else is a doctor. So this is like checking into the first class lounge and announcing it on Facebook. So a PhD is only worth, a PhD, and we can discuss that another day, PhD is totally useless according to me. But if you're going to extract any kind of value from it, it is essentially the same as, having some frequent flyer miles, because you have the right credit card. Okay, so it's of marginal importance. And of course, you're sacrificing something else by perhaps paying an annual fee in order to get those miles. But it doesn't matter. It allows you to say that I'm flying business class. So I like to mention the comma PhD only in such contexts where I think that it might provide me some kind of, added, wow, this guy has a PhD. But not when I'm going to talk about cricket, because I really have nothing to my PhD has got nothing to do with cricket. But coming to the topic for today, I was extremely disappointed by India's performance in the World Cup. I mean, when India lost to New Zealand, people were saying, come on, it's a game. And I absolutely agree that I'm hardly the fan at this, I'm being so old as I am, to kind of become distraught by defeat. Because I totally understand that that only one team will win this, and it's absolutely natural to be defeated. It's absolutely perfectly fine. But the thing is, as long as you are defeated by your own merits. So as an example, in 2015, the last time we had a World Cup, we lost in the semifinals also. And I was ecstatic. I mean, I wasn't ecstatic that we lost, but I felt that we did brilliantly, given that we were in Australia, a place where we have traditionally not performed well. And I honestly felt that the team was, at that point of time, I didn't feel the team was good enough to dominate all the league games, which India did in a very emphatic manner, in conditions that we Indian fans don't normally give our team a lot of chance, which is Australian bouncy pitches. So I felt that India did way better than I expected them to do, and I was very happy. I was very happy, not that they got eliminated, but I was very happy overall. I felt 2015 was a successful campaign. I would give it much, I would in my ranking of great World Cup campaigns put it higher above 2011, where it wins, but it wins in India. But this campaign was so disappointing, because it was, I don't know how to put it, but that... I've had enough of being berated by Dhoni fans, but since I've already gone through that gauntlet, let me run through that gauntlet. Let me just go ahead and say it. One of the reasons why we lost is not because we were outclassed by New Zealand. I refuse to accept the fact. New Zealand bowled well. Okay, fine. They bowled. They played decently, but we still should have won that game. And it's been consistently throughout the tournament, we have carried Dhoni. I mean, it doesn't matter whether Dhoni is a great batsman. Of course, nobody's disputing the fact that he's India's greatest captain. He's, you know, in terms, he's a legend. No, it doesn't matter. But even Sunil Gavaskar is a legend. Even Kapil Dev is a legend. Even Sachin Tendulkar is a legend. But we're not claiming that they should be playing now, right? So that was the problem with Dhoni. He just could not do it. And we were carrying this and we were carrying this. And his fans were like, oh no, on the day it comes, he will do it. Unfortunately, cricket doesn't happen like the ending of a comic strip. It doesn't happen. It's not a script written for Disha Patani. Okay, this is not Dhoni the biopic. This is Dhoni the reality. And we saw that, we knew this was going to happen. As a matter of fact, we knew going into the tournament that we were going to have a problem with the middle order. And there just didn't seem to be any strategy. It just seemed to be that the leadership had gone on vacation. We played better than we should have once Dhawan left, because of the top three, now there was only top two. Just that Rohit Sharma played so brilliantly that he covered up for Dhawan. Normally, if you look at their record, if you go through in five matches, they will normally score two centuries. One guy will score one century, another guy will score another century, and they'll get 30s in the others and they will fail in two of them. It's normally how those two, and since I play fantasy cricket, I know I've seen this pattern. But this time, Rohit Sharma totally bucked that pattern. He basically played for both of them. And this was the kind of once-in-a-lifetime performance, right? Rohit Sharma was brilliant. And you would normally expect, also Rohit Sharma was brilliant, the bowling was very good. But some of the decisions just made no sense. And that was what was disappointing. There were two things that was disappointing. It was more, you know, Dhoni was a problem. I mean, we all knew it, I called it out. But even Kohli, I mean, for all his greatness, it's when you want to be a World Cup winning captain, you have to. I mean, that is where it steps. I believe that's where it separates men from boys. So you have to step up at some point of time. Kapil Dev did. He stepped up at a time when the team was close to being eliminated. Even Dhoni in that final, I'm not saying India were going to get eliminated, but it's true that even though Gambhir, and I'm a huge fan of Gambhir, set up the whole innings, it was at a stage where it could have all fallen through at the time that he came into bat. The pressure was immense. And Yuvraj Singh is somebody who does not do pressure very well. So it was again, at that point of time, a great decision for him to come up in front, you know, to play the spinners. And it was that kind of innings, you know, soaking up that amount of pressure because the tournament was in India, you know, soaking up that pressure and playing. That was the innings which made it, you know, that was after, I mean, Dhoni had a very ordinary World Cup before that, if you recall. But it was that innings. It doesn't really matter, you know, if you're in a team and everybody else is pulling their weight, you can kind of fly under the radar. But what is expected of champions is that on the day when the support cast does not show up, perhaps because it's just their collective bad day, perhaps because the pitch or the conditions are not conducive, that it's that point of time where the champion really shows up. Okay, so for instance, you know, consider 2003 in that game, in that famous final, you know, Ricky Ponting, their captain, he shows up on that day. I mean, they lose two wickets. I mean, they're a far better team. By the way, 2003... 2003, again, India were playing far above their, far above their waist, you know, what do they call it in boxing? Right. Their weight category. And they were blasted out by an opposition which was light years ahead of them. So there was no regret at that point of time also. I mean, of course, felt bad, but it's no regret. I mean, there's no shame in losing to the Australia team of 2003. But again, the point was leadership. You know, Ricky Ponting in that stage. I mean, if he had gotten out for 5 runs in 2010 or 5 or 10 runs, who would have known, right? Who? In 1983, when we won the World Cup, it was Clive Lloyd. I mean, he didn't show leadership at that point of time. They lost. And Kapil Dev did. So if you go through the history of World Cups, you know, Gatting in 1987, he played that reverse sweep when they needed him to be the captain. And he could not step up to the plate. So it's very important if you look through the history of the World Cup, you'll see that in most cases, they're not the captain himself at some point of time or the other. I don't think Imran Khan stepped up, by the way, in 92. But Imran Khan is special. you know, with black lentil and everything. So the side, but yeah, I need to have my black lentil thing every episode. I just cannot get over that. But it is true. And this is where I felt Virat Kohli failed. And this was the biggest. I mean, he, as a batsman, there's nothing to say about him. Again, I also feel that this World Cup, there was not that dominant performance. He was playing like I would have expected KL Rahul to play if he was having a good tournament. He was playing as a good support cast, but he wasn't playing like the champion that he is. Only Rohit Sharma was in terms of batting. Everybody was batting around him, including Kohli. That was the tragedy. But again, this is all well and good if Kohli had been able to stand up during the semi-final. But the top three made one run each. And there was no way. That is the disappointing thing about the fans. It's that gutlessness, that spinelessness that you want to expect. You want your team to put up a fight. Of course, Jadeja put up a fight, but it was not his fight to put up. He needed support. And on that day, the whole team failed him. Dhoni was, in any case, Dhoni was a failure from the start to the finish. He shouldn't even have been in the team. But again, it's not a question of, again, hindsight is 2020. It is that India had a chance. The India were by far the better team in this World Cup. It was one of the very rare World Cups where we had arguably the best bowling lineup. Among that's almost has never happened, at least not never happened in my lifetime. And bowlers win matches, it's not batsmen. And we had this great opportunity and we blew it. We blew it because this team had zero leadership in terms of, this is not just an indictment of Kohli, but of course Ravi Shastri and the remaining think tank. And of course, I expect the Supreme Court to do something about it since they basically have taken it upon themselves, you know, to run Indian cricket. But what was going on with Ambati Raidu? What was going on with replacements? I mean, there just seemed to be Afghanistan was a mess and we were a mess. And now I read that Sanjay Bangar is likely to lose his job. What? Sanjay Bangar of all people? I mean, apparently, I didn't know that he was the batting coach, apparently. Who appointed Sanjay Bangar as the batting coach? I mean, this is exactly what happens, and this is a good segue into it. This is exactly what happens in corporations. And when somebody fails, it's usually the guy with the least influence with the management who gets fired, even though he might have nothing to do with the root causes. I mean, what could Sanjay Bangar have done? I read somewhere that the failure of India's batting is being blamed on Sanjay Bangar. What was his job? To teach them how to bat? Was Sanjay Bangar responsible for Dhoni's strike rate? No, he wasn't. So the fact is that Ravi Shastri, nothing will happen to him because Virat Kohli wants him. Because Virat Kohli wants Ravi Shastri. He doesn't, and we've gone over this before. He does not want any kind of strong oversight. He does not want a Kumble kind of leader who has his own viewpoint, who has his own. He just wants a yes man. He knows that he is, and we'll come to Kohli's management style, is that, and we'll talk about that when we come to it. So I wanted to use this podcast today to do something which I've been wanting to do for a long time, which is to take each of the most influential captains that I have seen. Again, this whole discussion is purely scoped based on my lifetime. So I'm not going to talk about ML Jayashima or MAK Patawdy because I didn't see them. I mean, I'm old, but not that old. So I'll start off with, different captaincy styles that I've seen and, how I've also seen their analogs in the corporate world. Because each of them I found remarkable, even their similarities, but each of the captains that I have seen, the major captains, I'm not going to talk about Ravi Shastri, who was captain for this one test, or Virendra Sehwag, or Gautam Gambhir, but people who we think of as Indian captains, who had some kind of impact on the leadership culture of the Indian cricket team. I've seen that they're reasonably diverse, I would say. And I personally have seen corporate leaders like them, each of them. And I won't take names, of course, with respect to the corporate leaders, but I'll definitely take names with respect to the cricket captains. So first, Sunil Gavaskar. So, and again, I'm guessing that given the audience of this podcast, most of you guys who are listening to this podcast have seen Sunil Gavaskar bat. And Sunil Gavaskar's leadership style, and you might have seen Sunil Gavaskar bat, but you might not have seen Sunil Gavaskar as a captain. So Sunil Gavaskar's captaincy style kind of reflected the age that he grew up in. It was the age of Indira Gandhi heavy duty socialism, of 25-point Garibi Hatao, and the only thing that held the country together, to quote Yes Prime Minister, was red tape. So Gavaskar's leadership style was very much based on the avoidance of error. So he was ultra conservative with respect to everything. And for him, it made sense, because he was really, he and Vishwanath were the only two international all-surface batsmen that this team had. And so their major, the whenever they took the field, remember Sunil Gavaskar, our bowling was so bad that Sunil Gavaskar also used to open the bowling sometimes in terms of our pace resources. So Sunil Gavaskar, yes. So Sunil Gavaskar, you know, kind of reminiscent of the Afghan captain, but in a totally different context. But the thing about Sunil Gavaskar was his captaincy was utterly lifeless, boring, and he had to be. And Sunil Gavaskar always has said that he had to bat and he had to captain that way because the team was like that. And at the end of his career, you know, when he, I don't know if you remember, he became a much more aggressive batsman at the end. And he was pretty good at it too. It was, I remember that innings he played against West Indies in Delhi in 1983, where he scored a runner ball century, which was his 29th century. I guess, Vikram, you didn't, you're too young to have seen that, I'm guessing.
Probably not too young, but we didn't have a TV set in any case. Okay.
So what happened was that in the previous test match at Kanpur, Gavaskar was playing one of his traditional Gavaskar innings, which is to kind of be a stonewall. And this was the second innings, and we were losing the game badly. I think we were losing by an innings. This was right after the Cricket World Cup, where West Indies' full team came here determined to send the message that that World Cup victory was a fluke, and they were by far the best team in the world, which they were, and they did show it. Anyway, so in that Kanpur game, what happened was Sunil Gavaskar was defending when, and we saw this on television, what happened was the ball bounced and hit his bat handle. Whatever it was, again, there was not a lot of television replays, but the image that was, that all that entire India saw, was that the bat flew from Gavaskar's hand. So the ball was so fast that Gavaskar, whose technique was beyond reproach, the bat flew away from his hand like he was like a teenager. It was like, I remember the Bengali newspapers next day came up with this, that, you know, it was the moment like seeing Arjun drop his Gandhi. You know, that's when Arjun, and the implications were obvious that this is time for Gavaskar to retire, just as it was Arjun's time to retire after he dropped his Gandhi bow. And so after that happened, and Gavaskar in one of his books said that, he said that it, you know, it came up across as much more dramatic as it was. What happened was when the ball is bouncing, he would very loosely hold the bat because there was a forward short leg. And so that the ball hitting the bat does not carry to forward short leg, that it kind of drops at his foot. But the bat ball came and hit the handle. And so since he was holding it very loosely, it slipped away from his hand. So it was not that he couldn't see the ball and it hit his. So it looked far more dramatic than it was. But what Gavaskar decided at that point of time was that he had had enough. He had it enough of like batting like that. Next time, if somebody bowled a bouncer to him, he was going to hook it, which he'd never done before. You know, consistently. So, and the next test match in Delhi, he just came out and scored a runner ball century, which in those days was unheard of in a test match. I think it was better than a runner ball. It's possibly 92 balls or something. And opening against full Malcolm Marshall. Again, the pitch was easy, but the point I was trying to say was that Gavaskar's, you know, stodgy management style and stodgy batting style was not natural. He had to do it because of the limitations of his team. And I always have admired him because of that. Because once I saw him play like that, he also had the game, his last one-day game in a World Cup semifinal where he lost his stump to Philip De Freitas. The game just before that, it was in 1987. Did you see that game, Vikram, where it was against New Zealand and he Chris Srikanth like blasted this New Zealand attack?
Might have.
Scoring in those days at 6.5 runs an over, which was in those, it's like in today's time, scoring at 10 runs an over.
Wow.
That impact. So they just went berserk on New Zealand, Chris Srikanth and Sunil Gavaskar. This was his penultimate game. I remember Yohan Chatfield and all of these, they used to play for New Zealand. And anyways, so Gavaskar's leadership style, I've always seen, is very analogous to Babu's in government. So I once heard of this this preeminent research organization in India, where apparently for about half the year, they spent their time deciding on what font the annual report should be. I'm not making this up. At the font and the formatting. And again, these were days before Microsoft Word, so it was not as simple as just going and changing the styles. So, you know, before you millennials whoever start laughing and thinking I'm making this up. In those days, you know, font meant, you know, writing it, actually typing it, then looking through. So it was a lot of effort, but the entire focus of that organization and of leadership was essentially in the avoidance of error. They did not come to work to make money, or they did not come to work to win in that respect. They came to work so that they could keep their work. And the easiest way of keeping their work was to show that they were compliant. So one class of leaders that you will always find in the corporate world are those who are absolutely driven by the need to be compliant. So they will not take, so their main thing is always come to work and cover your ass. Okay, so always be compliant. Again, their focus is never really on risk. It's never really on making a profit. Again, this kind of comes with the socialist mindset, but in making sure that the fonts are correct. So these people preoccupy themselves with irrelevant minutiae. And I don't know if any of you listeners have ever worked under such a manager, but these people will spend weeks on a presentation to make sure that the fonts work fine, to make sure that the bullets are properly arranged, to make sure that if you have the header image here in the next place, it is not even one pixel displaced. So these people, that is the Gavaskar style of leadership. And once you have that leadership style, it kind of percolates down the organization, such that everybody becomes obsessed with details that don't matter. And the reason why they do that is because they feel that provides them some kind of security. Because, hey, if the font looks good, people will say, you know what, these guys are paying attention to their job. The fonts are good. The bullet points align visually. They are less, because they're not confident of their content, exactly in the way Gavaskar was not confident of the people he was playing with. And that the only way that they could sustain as a team was making sure that they did not do or commit anything which was rash. And that's exactly where the next captain, Kapil Dev, comes in, because he was the first captain to introduce rashness within the context of this carefully calibrated socialist world, socialist dystopia, some might say, that Gavaskar was a symbol of. So again, Vikram, again, are you old enough to remember the conflict between Kapil Dev and Gavaskar?
Just read about it. The two, in recent times, I wasn't privy to it when it happened.
So the fact that Gavaskar and Kapil Dev never quite got on was always stuff of newspapers. In those days, there was no social media. So it was fairly well known. And the conflict between them essentially came from, between Gavaskar's innate discipline and Kapil Dev's innate lack of discipline. So Kapil Dev was a different kind of leader. Perhaps the first, he kind of was a precursor to a new generation of leadership. But Kapil Dev had his own problems. Kapil Dev's thing was he was a very instinctive captain. he relied on instincts. He was not a person for plans. He was not a person for dotting the T's, dotting the I's and crossing the T's. He was exactly opposite to that. So all of his, he was kind of a startup, if I might say so, kind of a startup culture at a time in which this culture was absolutely alien in the world. So even if you look at his, you know, if you hear the stories of his 1983 winning campaign after India got out, I think he, I'm not sure whether it's the world, it was the final or one of the previous games. He basically told everybody in lunch to basically go to sleep. Let's just have a short nap between the games. I think it's not the World Cup final, it's one of the previous ones where we also had a batting collapse. So he basically said, you know what, just get it out of your... I mean, these kind of things were not something which Gavaskar would ever make people do. He would say, go to the nets. That's what he would say. But he said, you know what, forget it. Just go to sleep. Take a rest. Get it off your mind. So his was that kind of captaincy. It was extremely... So this was, again, another kind of manager. This manager does not listen to any strategy, does not listen to any plan, gives two hoots about compliance. He just decides, he comes to work and he decides what he wants to do. He is focused on results. He is ethical. At least Kapil Dev, when he started out, was a very ethical person. His captaincy, his leadership is inspirational. And I've also worked with managers for whom people, you know, when that manager leaves the company, his team leaves the company. There's no other reason except that they don't want to work for the company. They want to work for the manager. There's a loyalty to that person. That person is a natural leader. He influences. And because people believe that he will stand by them, because people believe his judgment, people believe that he's a kind of guy who, if senior management comes to him, he doesn't, you know, kiss up and kick down. He will say what he believes in. He might be right, he might be wrong, but he is the way he is. And Kapil Dev was exactly that kind of leader. And that is what got him into conflict with Sunil Gavaskar. And the conflict came to a head in a series against England in 1985, a home series in which Kapil Dev, if you recall, Kapil Dev had this rather innovative way of playing when he was under pressure. Sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't. I mean, one of the great examples of when it worked was in, I think it was Lords when we were following on. And Kapil Dev, in order to avoid the follow-on, hit four sixes, successive sixes of Eddie Hemmings. So this was an extremely high-risk gambit. This is not out of the Gavaskar school of playing cricket. So this was the very high-risk things that Kapil Dev used to do. And these were things which he took on himself. He would not ask somebody else to do the high-risk things. That's not what a good leader does. The leader does the risky things himself because he's willing to face the consequences of what will happen if things go south. And there were two notable instances in which this didn't work. One of the famous cases was in 1987 semi-final, when again, Kapil Dev pretty much had the game in its control. We were chasing around 250, which in those days was like chasing 325 in those days. But India were pretty much on course at one point of time, and Kapil Dev had the game under control. And then again, totally against what would be sound cricketing sense, he decided to hit a six with the entire mid-wicket region crowded with fielders. There was no reason for him to do so, but he just decided that I'll take that risk. So he had that instinctive style to him, and he brought, you know, under him, he brought that kind of style to the team, which was again a breath of fresh air, but it brought him into great conflict with Sunil Gavaskar, who was at that point of time still in the team, but he was always like, sometimes he was the captain, sometimes he was not the captain. And then it came to a real head when, under Gavaskar's captaincy against in the England series in 1985, it was the fourth innings, India were trying to save the game, and Kapil Dev decided to hit, I think the bowler's name was Pat Pocock. Tried to hit Pat Pocock for a six, and he holed out. And when he came back, according to rumor, Gavaskar told the then manager that this guy is not going to play as long as I'm the captain ever again. I'm not going to captain with him. And so, of course, that never happened because it was Kapil Dev. But what happened was that disciplinary action was taken against Kapil Dev, and he did not play the next test match in Calcutta.
I believe that was the only time he was rested.
Only time, which is why he still regrets the fact that it was the only time he ever missed a test match. He never missed a test match due to fitness. The only time he ever missed was because he was disciplined. And I remember in Calcutta, there were this posters came up, no Kapil, no test. Because, you know, Calcutta people never liked Sunil Gavaskar. And then the hatred was mutual. So Gavaskar didn't want to come to play in Calcutta. Calcutta people booed Gavaskar whenever he came out to bat. So this was always, according to some conspiracy theories, you know, that Gavaskar didn't want to play the World Cup final, 87 final in Calcutta, whatever it is. That gets into the Basit Ali realm of things. But the point is that Kapil Dev's management style, that instinctive management style, that kind of do it by the seat of the pants, no process, just get the job done no matter how it is, take insane risks. That kind of culture was Kapil Dev's leadership. Ultimately, I think he was ahead of his times. And people, whether it be Raj Singh Dungarpur or who was the venerable manager who basically represented the management of the Indian cricket team at that point of time, Kapil Dev was basically uncontrollable. And so there was this series of captains like Dilip Vengsarkar, who was also extremely political captain, till the next phase opened up with Mohammad Azharuddin. And I think now at least Vikram, you should have been clued into what was going on with the famous Raj Singh Dungarpur Mia Kapatam Banoge.
Yes.
And so when Azharuddin was made the captain, he was made captain precisely because the board had enough of these assertive, aggressive captains like Kapil Dev and then Vengsarkar.
Let me interrupt you there for a minute though.
Sure.
Purely because it's you, I have to ask this question. Since you're one of the few people who saw Azhar the movie, is this scene depicted in the movie and who plays Dungarpur?
Man, I don't remember the movie, man.
Do they have the scene though?
I think they do. I think they might have that scene. I remember there was
such
a guy.
Iconic.
I thought there was a guy who was playing Ravi Shastri. There was a guy who was playing Sidhu, of course. There was definitely a guy playing Manoj Prabhakar. But I don't recall Raj Singh Dungarpur.
I didn't mean to interrupt your train of thought, sorry, but I just needed to know about the movie.
No, so then what happened was and India also at that point of time was changing, and Azharuddin represented the new India. New India is in the new India of the early 1990s, where with liberalization, the markets were opening, but it also coming along with that was corruption, and Azharuddin represented the best and the worst of his times, in the sense that he did take India to the next level. For the first time, India became, at least on home grounds, an unbeatable force. When in the 80s, India were highly beatable on Indian grounds. I mean, nobody knew if India would win a home series. But then under Azharuddin in the early 90s, with a bowling attack consisting of Anil Kumble and Venkatapathy Raju and Rajesh Chauhan from time to time, at least, I mean, we still sucked outside, but at least in India for at least 3 or 4 years, we became practically invincible. So with Sachin, making his mark, and with Azharuddin as the captain, this was the next phase. This was when I was really into cricket at this phase of my life. And Azharuddin used to, and I've said this before, used to be my favorite batsman. He was given what he did, that was why I have nothing left of my love for him. But he was my cricket hero. You know, I used to like his batting way more than I like Sachin or Saurav or Rahul Dravid. But he brought with him that, you know, he was both a transformational leader. He was transformational in the sense that, you know, he brought fielding. It was the first captain. I mean, Kapil Dev was a good fielder too, but of course nowhere near Azharuddin. So Azharuddin was trying to change, and he's the kind of captain and he's the kind of leader you'll find in the corporate world who tries to transform the corporate culture. You know, he brought in a notion of physical fitness that was absolutely not there in the side before. I remember there was, this was 90s, and there was some physical trainer, some Olympic physical trainer that the board brought, and they, I don't know, possibly something like yo-yo test, but they made all the cricketers go through it to see which of them are, and they said that none of the players, except two, qualified as at the level of international athletes. And the only two players who qualified were Ajay Jadeja, very young Ajay Jadeja, and Mohammad Azharuddin. The rest of them were not considered to be at the level of an international athlete. So you can imagine the level of fitness. But Azharuddin, again, he's the kind of leader who, again, I've seen this kind of leader who does not have a strong sense of ethics, but is ultimately is a transformational figure. You know, he brings in something which, and Azharuddin did change Indian cricket in many respects, but his captaincy style also. But he was not, and we will come to the next guy, Sachin, who was on the side of being a micromanager. But he was the very hands-off manager that you would find. You know, the kind of people who you actually like. Because I remember Azharuddin, the main thing was that he was criticized for being very laid back on the field. So if some bowler was bowling badly, he wouldn't do anything. He would just stand there.
And that's a Hyderabadi.
Yes, and then somebody came and told him that, why don't you do something? I mean, you're the manager. You know, manage, goddammit. And he said, what do you expect me to say? I mean, well, he doesn't know. He, of course, knows what he has to do. He's an international bowler. I mean, what am I going to tell him at that point of time? And all I can do is do something later. But at that point of time, it makes no sense for me to come out and just to show everybody, look, I'm doing something. I don't have to go and tell him. He knows what he has to do. Again, that made sense. But that's, again, a mark of a good manager. Azharuddin did have, he was a good manager, actually. I like managers like that. You know, managers who they know that there are times, you know, when he have an employee evaluation, then go and tell him. But doesn't mean that you know, snoop around his cubicle all the day to see, oh, are you doing your work? Oh, you didn't do this. And doesn't come and like provide you with continuous negative feedback. You know, negative feedback and positive feedback is good. You can always provide continuous positive feedback. But negative feedback, at least the way I like to be managed and the way I like to manage, is negative feedback should be given at very specific times. Because there is no good way to give negative feedback, no matter what management books will tell you. So you should not be giving continual negative feedback to someone, but you should possibly definitely be giving continuous positive feedback. And Azharuddin's captaincy style was about, in vast contrast to Kohli, who is all about continuous negative feedback, is Azharuddin's style was very laid back. I don't know when he gave his negative feedback, but at least nobody saw it. He was essentially didn't say anything. But again, Azharuddin's reputation would be tarnished, as is tarnished for many managers and many administrators, by ultimately what all of us knew, what he did. Which brings us to the guy who kind of started along with Azharuddin, and it was Sachin Tendulkar. Now, Sachin Tendulkar is the classical example of when you take your hotshot super engineer and make him into your manager. And he is a total failure at it. Because the reason why he's a failure is almost the same exact same reasons why he's that super individual contributor. He is the best. He's the best engineer in the side. But he is absolutely so self-absorbed that he's unable to empathize with those who are not as skilled as he is. All his strategies, and this I've heard and again read, was the persistent criticism of Sachin, that he refuses to believe that everybody else is not Sachin. And again, I've seen people in companies, in engineering companies, managers like this. They are super rock star engineers themselves who got promoted to management. And then they believe that their team has to be meet his levels or that they're not worth it. They set unreasonable high expectations. And their evaluation of everybody is through their own prism. Again, if I can do it, why can't you? That is essentially what's going through his mind. And this was, from what I read, was Sachin's problem, which was why once this happened, and once his own performance started to fall, and this also happens to many engineers who become very unsuccessful managers, is once they become managers, they themselves start falling in the thing that they were very good at. And so either they get kicked out or they are, and if the management is good, then they shift him back into his individual contributor position and say, you know what, your management stuff isn't really working. You're not a good leader. You know, you cannot deliver. You can do your stuff, but you cannot deliver. And why does that happen? And I remember
somebody told me this, that you know, when I was transitioning from being an individual contributor to, you know, managing my team, he said, you know, Arnab, look at this thing. I mean, the biggest difference that you're going to have is that when you're an individual contributor, you know that you live and you die by your own performance. You are evaluated purely on your own performance. And that itself is, and you don't realize it yet, but that in itself is a big cause of happiness. Because you know that when I'm given something, I know I can do it. And you have, and the person you trust most in this world ultimately is you yourself. However, as you become a manager and as you ascend in the management hierarchy, you will find that the volume of work that is going to be assigned to you is going to be such that, first of all, you will not even yourself know technically what to do. So you will have to trust somebody else to do it for you and be ready to take the consequence of when that person cannot do it. And managers react to it, especially people like you who grow from individual contributors, they react to it in two ways. One way is that they basically stop doing their work because they just become paralyzed by the fact that they don't know anything. And that just creates it. Oh man, when I was an individual contributor, I used to know everything. Now I don't know anything. And there are always crises going all over the place. So that's one thing. And they end up having a heart attack. The second thing what happens is something very similar, but that guy tries to do everything at that point of time. He tries to go and become a micromanager. He tries to get that same level of control that he used to have when he was an individual contributor, except it becomes increasingly impossible to do that because of the sheer number of people he has under him and the sheer number of tasks that he has to deliver on, which, and that result of that is that guy delivers on some tasks and absolutely lets fall some other things. And that's what gets him out of the organization at that point of time. So, again, these are very good words of advice, I felt. And Sachin Tendulkar is the example of that individual contributor who just could not manage because of precisely the fact that he was such a good individual contributor. Which leads to the next guy, Ganguly, who actually had the best. He was not a great individual contributor, by the way. If you look at this set of batsmen, he was the weakest in the group of the great batsman era that we had in the late 90s and early 2000s.
Sehwag.
Okay. Sehwag, Sachin, Dravid, Ganguly, Lakshman. There's no two ways about it. Ganguly is the weakest batsman among them. But
which says so much about that lot, doesn't it? I mean, Ganguly is a world class even by today's standards.
Yes, but he's the weakest. There's no doubt about it. He's the weakest among all of them in terms of his core skills. Yeah, he was a good all-rounder. He was, you know, some places, perhaps, you know, if he had been born in the T20 generation, he perhaps would have been better than VVS Lakshman and Rahul Dravid because he could bowl and he was aggressive batsman. But in any case, these are all hypotheticals. But given the era that they played in, he was by far the weakest of these five. And yet he was their greatest leader that they had. The reason why was that, and again, this is because Ganguly, perhaps more than anybody else, and the greatest achievement was Ganguly, was when he took over. He took over at a time when Indian cricket had lost its credibility in front of its fans, in front of the world. And honestly, I mean, I was so disappointed in this, you know, at that point of time when all these revelations came out about Azharuddin and, you know, people like me who for whom cricket is a religion. I mean, even I had almost decided that, you know, I'm not going to follow this game anymore. I mean, I don't even trust. This is like World WWF wrestling at this point of time. I mean, everything is made up. But what he did was over, you know, next decade, he basically restored, you know, not just him, of course, him and that entire team, and Anil Kumble included. Anil Kumble, Javagal, Srinath, that entire team for that next 10 years, they basically made us believe again that no matter whether we won or lost, we were going to be trying our best. And Ganguly was that excellent dream manager, the dream man manager that you, everybody wants to have. Given that he was not the greatest of individual contributors, he understood everybody's limitations. He understood everybody's limitations, but when push came to shove, he had that authority, that, you know, that leadership to step forward. I think that 144 in Adelaide that he scored on a tough pitch, you know, going ahead of Sachin Tendulkar. You know, that is when the leader comes out. A leader is normally, you expect, you know, a good manager is somebody who stays behind. It's often said that the, you know, Kapil Dev's thing is he's the first guy to jump into battle. You know, that guy is might be somebody you may want to die for. He might be good in the military, but he's not good in a corporate environment. You know, the manager isn't the guy who kind of goes, you know, goes with the banner and runs in the front. A good manager is somebody like Ganguly, who actually stays behind and he lets his people go up. But, and his critics would say he used to do that because he was not good enough, which is a valid criticism. And that might be valid criticism for many managers too. They're not essentially the best individual contributors. So they're not going to be the guys who are going to run into the most difficult parts of the code. They can't. They know their limitations. They not only know everybody else's limitations, they know their own limitations. But his credit was he gave people their space. He was able to work with difficult people. The reason why people like Yuvraj Singh and Harbhajan and Sehwag are so still respectful of Ganguly and always acknowledge, you know, his contribution to them, to their careers, was because they were individually all difficult people to work with. In the greatest managers I've seen are people who can work with difficult people. I mean, of course, difficult people who are incompetent usually end up losing their jobs. But then there are some people who are just difficult to work with because they're not like other people. But a good leader, a good manager is able to put them in the correct roles. If somebody is very mufat, you know, just says what he wants, you normally wouldn't expect that guy to be in a customer-facing role, right? If somebody puts him in a customer-facing role, then the manager is not doing his job. So Ganguly was a great manager in that respect, in the sense that he understood the strengths and the weaknesses of his team, and he put them in the right roles. And he was willing to fight for them. That's another thing which a great leader and a great corporate manager does, is that he fights for his team. He is not a guy who rolls over and points fingers back at his team. He takes responsibility for his actions and he protects his team. If he knows that you did what he told you to do, he will protect you from other people. And I think based on the kind of goodwill that Ganguly still has among the people who led, that was his biggest thing, is that, you know, for difficult people like Harbhajan, who, I don't know if you know the story, but he was not going to be selected for that famous 2001 series.
Oh, didn't know that.
So he had been turned out from this training camp. Do you know the story? So it was, I remember, so he was at that point of time, so there was another bowler at that point of time called Sharandeep Singh, if you remember.
Yes, I do. Yeah.
So Harbhajan had been banned because he had apparently picked up a fight at one of these training camps run by the BCCI. Because of the quality of food that was given to him.
Not so surprising.
Harbhajan being Harbhajan, of course, you know, I'm pretty sure you can guess what he did. And they decided that they're not going to, you know, they first banned him. And it was unofficially, they said, we're not going to play. You know, he's never going to play. Okay, pretty much we don't want to play with a guy with this kind of attitude. And so they wanted Sharandeep Singh to play. Apparently he didn't, I don't think he minded the food perhaps. But it was Ganguly who insisted that it has to be Harbhajan Singh. It doesn't matter what he did. He will work with him. He takes responsibility from now on for his, you know, for his hot-headedness. But that, you know, purely on the strength of ability, Harbhajan has to play. And Harbhajan proved him right. Of course, he was a class above Sharandeep Singh or anybody, any of the other spinners that we had in those days. And so Ganguly's leadership was like that. If you look at, you know, he was able to choose people. He was able to choose not the most obvious people. I mean, Rahul Dravid at one point of time, I remember there was a time when people were saying that Rahul Dravid does not have a slot in the one-day team. It was then that the whole wicket-keeping thing came up. And Rahul Dravid, after he became a wicketkeeper, actually became a much better one-day batsman. Once he had the confidence that he had a role in the team, he could then improvise, and he became a much, much better one-day batsman. Till at the end of his till the end of the career, he was a better one-day batsman than Ganguly himself, because Rahul Dravid intrinsically is a better batsman than Ganguly. That's the reason. So, you know, if you give him the confidence, he can learn things much quicker than Ganguly can, because
just he's a better batsman. That's why. So again, you can say that just goes to show that Rahul Dravid was better than Ganguly. Not really. He was a better batsman, but in terms of leadership, a lot of Dravid's career is basically he was led by the right guy under somebody else. I'm not sure that all of those people would have been able to make it. And you know, if you had a Ganguly in the 1990s, for instance, maybe Indian cricket history would have been different at that point of time. Maybe Atul Bedade would be considered an all-time great. Who knows? Maybe Sairaj Bahutule would have been Kumble before Sairaj Bahut before Kumble. Who knows? So it's often, you know, it's often about, you know, how you manage these people. And of course, they're artists, especially in a corporate environment. Corporations tend to be not like artists and, you know, people who have their own attitude. But you know, Ganguly was a person who could work with artists. He could work with artists, maybe because he was a bit of an artist himself, you know, given his own history of not taking shit from people, and you know, he understood that. So that's why I consider Ganguly to be the greatest leader that India had, even though, of course, in terms of record, Dhoni's record is far better. But in terms of pure leadership, in terms of his legacy, if you look at the people that Dhoni built versus the people that Ganguly built, you would find that there is a difference. Which, of course, brings me to Mahendra Singh Dhoni. So Mahendra Singh Dhoni, again, the great part of the greatest thing about Mahendra Singh Dhoni, and he is the kind of manager, the kind of leader who is very, very well grounded in terms of, for him, cricket, and I've written this before, is a job. Okay. Unlike Ganguly and unlike many of cricketers before, for whom it was kind of a passion thing, his main thing was it's a job. And given that he thought of it as a job, given that he was able to take the passion out of it, he was much more effective. So the famous thing that Dhoni brought, among many things, was, you know, his chasing technique, where he would basically take it to the end of the game and try to finish it at the very end. Now, this is, again, to use a management cliche, a very out-of-the-box thing. But if you think through it dispassionately, this is the way to do things. Now, it's true that now Dhoni can't do it, not because the strategy is wrong, but basically because he does not have the ability anymore. This hand-eye coordination is lost, so that he cannot, given the last four or five balls, he cannot reliably put them away for 20 runs. But the logic that Dhoni used to follow is, again, the kind of logic that great leaders often can come up with. Okay, people who are not following standard management practices or the standard way of doing things, but are thinking, again, I hate this word, but out of the box. So his main thing was, okay, so when you are batting and you have, let's say, 80 runs to get in the last 10 overs. Okay, so the one way you can try to do is to try to, you know, make sure that the asking rate does not go up. Okay, so you try to score at 7 runs an over, try to score at 8 runs an over. But just from a purely bowling perspective, what you're doing is, given the fact that the bowler has still 10 overs remaining, and you only get, if you're out, you're out. The risk for you is much higher. The risk for the bowling side is much lower. Even if he gets hit for a six, he can come back the next ball. So, and because he knows that the numbers are in his favor, he also, the pressure and the stress does not get to him. It's a virtuous circle. So he also, the bowler also will bowl the balls in the right areas because he knows the fact that the risk, the thing is with him. Now, what Dhoni did, and that was the revolutionary part, was that he didn't try to get it at 8 runs and over. He would try to get it at 5 runs and over and 6 runs and over. And in the last 3 overs, maybe he has to score at 12 or 15 runs and over. But by that time, because he is still there, the needle of the risk has now started moving towards the bowler. Now it's different. If the bowler misses 2 Yorkers and they go for 6, well, then 12 runs out of the 15 have been scored in 2 balls. So now, because Dhoni is still there, and because the bowler doesn't have a lot of room, and Dhoni does, even though
Dhoni hasn't taken any extra risk for the last 8 overs, then the needle of the risk has firmly moved towards the bowler. And more often than not, the bowler would then start feeling the pressure. And countless number of times we have seen that over the last 10 years that happened to bowlers across the world, that when Dhoni takes it to the end, it's the bowler who loses his nerve. This is also contingent upon Dhoni himself trusting himself to not lose his nerve. So that was something which he brought in, this almost mathematical, this automatic mathematical, very cerebral, risk-based approach to batting and to captaincy. That's exactly the thing with his famous intuition about the DRS. He basically plays the numbers. He does not go on passion. You know, most cricketers are passionate. You know, he does not go on passion. I remember when the IPL game was one of the ones in which he tells the bowler, you're not going to get it. But I'm just calling it because, you know, it's okay, man. I'll just do it for you. But you're not going to get it. So because Dhoni, when he's a wicketkeeper, he can take those judgment calls instantly. So he's that kind of manager. And again, these are managers I've seen who have enormous amount of risk mitigation and risk control in their brain. Everything they say, they do not react to things. When you give them a huge amount of work, for instance, you say, okay, the project is due 3 weeks from now. Some of the managers are going to immediately go passionate and start shouting and say, this is no way this we can do this. You know, who said we can do this? Dhoni is not a person who's going to do that. He is going to dispassionately, even when the burden is huge, he will dispassionately in his brain, and that comes very natural to him. He is the calm, cooling manager, the guy who is unflappable. Okay, when senior managers overload him, he doesn't go and immediately fight for his team and say, no, there's no way I'm going to be able to deliver on this. He absorbs the pressure. Okay, he absorbs the pressure, and then he might not be able to deliver. You know, when just like, you know, on these chases, at the end, he just can't do it. But again, his reaction to it is simply, you know, we tried, we couldn't do it. It's not the fighting. Ganguly would fight. Ganguly would shout. But then he possibly would not be able to do it either. But Dhoni, the thing is, he will try to do it in the way he believes. He has an inherent, almost godly understanding of risk. What lets him down now is not his brain for risk, but his abilities. It's just that he can't do it anymore. He himself can't do it anymore. There needs to be somebody else. And there was nobody else like Dhoni. We never built up somebody like Dhoni. Maybe somebody could say it's not possible, but I don't think that's true. I think that we could have built up, let's say, Rishabh Pant to bat like that. Because I think Rishabh Pant has the ability, perhaps not now, perhaps you'll have it 2 years later, but he potentially has the ability to be able to score, you know, hit 3 or 4 sixes straight up, you know, that Andre Russell kind of thing. So that brings us to the current captain, Virat Kohli. And there's a reason why Virat Kohli, you know, I know I'll get a lot of flack from Virat Kohli's fanboys, you know, he's won his test match and everything. But Virat Kohli, for me, is not a great captain. Because the main problem with Virat Kohli is he's trying to work on it in his defense. But that aggression that comes, you know, he wears his heart on his sleeve, and as his major psycho fan Ravi Shastri likes to say, I like boys who express themselves. No, you don't like boys who express themselves. No corporate environment, and cricket is a corporate environment, as Dhoni conclusively proved, can run on people expressing themselves, especially if the leader starts expressing himself. So for Kohli, it's like whenever somebody, I'm sure Vikram, you've seen Kohli, right? You know, there's always that BCMC on his lips, whether it be his own player or whether it be the opponent player.
Yes.
And he just, whether it's the famous Kohli face, whether he's running and he's like, you know, we have won the game, or whether he's BCMC, he's shaking his hand. You know, that's not passion. You know, that's essentially being reactive. That's a reactive manager. That's a kind of micromanager who rushes to your cubicle every 5 minutes. And, you know, did you get my mail? Why didn't you respond to my mail? That kind of manager. Okay. So that is the problem with Kohli. And that's why Bangalore perhaps has never won the IPL. That's
Tell perhaps- me something. you said, of course, the other great, Sachin was also a micromanager. So,
but Sachin, difference was that Sachin didn't rush to you. Sachin was a micromanager, but his micromanagement was not on the field.
Ah, okay.
Okay. His micromanagement was more like there's some silent micromanagers too. He will tell you to do something and then you fail. And then he silently sits in his cubicle and sighs.
This is a list of things you didn't do, or this is how you should have done this.
Yes, but he sighs. He's more like, you know, look at the people they have sent me. Remember, Sachin once said that. So he was that kind of a manager. He was not the manager. He was not a fan of violent feedback. He was a fan of feedback, but his feedback was do this, do that, and then those do this, do that were not possible for mortals most of the time. But then he would kind of sit back on his haunches and say, you know what can I do? Stupid, they sent me, you know, my team is stupid, what can I do? That was his management style. Kohli is not that. He doesn't think his team is stupid, and it isn't. You know, he manages a team which is, you know, way beyond what Sachin ever had in terms of overall quality. So he can't even claim that. But the fact that the response that he does, among the Indian cricket players, you would see one person who doesn't do this. And that's why I think he might potentially be a captaincy option at one point of time, is Bumrah. Even when people feel badly of his bowling, even when people drop catches, he doesn't, you see, doesn't react. Yes,
absolutely, absolutely.
He'll smile and he'll walk back. Of course, he feels the frustration, but he'll smile, shake his head and walk back. So he has, and it's very important. If you look at the really successful captains, take an example of a very, very ultra-aggressive captain, Ricky Ponting. The difference between Ricky Ponting and Kohli is that Ricky Ponting would never shout at his own teammates. He would shout at the other guys. Sure, Ricky Ponting gets hits on the bouncer by Srinath, and Ricky Ponting starts shouting at Srinath, and Srinath starts apologizing. See, that's Ricky Ponting. But Ricky Ponting would not go and... I don't recall him ever shouting at Brettley or ever shouting at McGrath on the field. See, this is where the good... See, I don't know what he does within the confines of his dressing room or, you know, during his annual evaluation. But at least there... He is standing behind on a public platform. He's standing behind his team. He doesn't feel that it's his place to give aggressive feedback there, even though he himself is an overtly aggressive person. At least he used to be.
Right. Let me ask you about one of the greatest, I mean, at least according to me, one of the greatest minds in Indian cricket, I'm talking about Anil Kumble. I mean, he had a very short stint as a captain and again a short stint as a coach. Is it purely the people management aspect? I mean, you know, having to manage somebody like Kohli I don't remember who all were the folks when he was the captain. But any insights on Kumble, the captain?
So insights, I think the reason why, again, we never saw a lot of Kumble as a captain, but we saw a lot of Kumble. We didn't see also a lot of Kumble as a manager, but we did see a lot of the conflict that he had with Kohli. So the thing is, Kumble is a person who, and Kohli is
an individual performer.
So Kohli is the kind of person who is like most Indian politicians. He does not like any kind of dissent anywhere. Okay, so it's his, there's a kind of manager who doesn't like, not only, and given the amount of influence he has in the team, he gets to choose his own manager. That's a prerogative which very few people have. So he doesn't want a manager who wants to do his job and actually manage. He does not want any oversight. He does not want any second opinion. He wants a manager who will massage his shoulder. Literally. Ravi Shastri literally massages his shoulder. So he wants, and he is given that kind of authority by the board, which is a failing of the Board of Cricket Control of India, that they allow this one person to basically do whatever he wants. And the problem with Kumble was that, again, Kumble has his own opinions. He has his own notion of what needs to be done. And he was surprised by the fact that the person who he was supposed to oversee could actually go above him to his bosses. And his bosses were willing to listen to him rather than the person they should be listening to. So Kumble, again, I don't think I don't know what his personal management philosophy was because I never saw it, but he had one. And it was evidently not something which was in tune with the way Kohli does things. And that Kohli, it's not even clear what he does. He tends to go a lot on gut. He tends to be a little bit of Kapil Dev in him.
So he will select, he will have his out of the box selections. Like, what was the name of that guy he played in that Sydney test? Forgotten his, Karan Sharma. You'll have these disastrous gut feeling things, but it's okay to do that. But I think it's fine to go with your gut, and things might fail, and that's fine. You don't want to come across as Sunil Gavaskar kind of captain. But it's just that overt aggressiveness often to his own team, that I don't think that he sees like a guy who actually stands by his own teammates at a time when they need it the most. You know, when you're out on the field and you've just misfielded or you've bowled a bad ball, you as a player are having a terrible time. You know what you've done. You've done it under the, you know, with millions of people watching. At that point of time, the last thing you need is to see your boss making eyes at you. And see, this is where Dhoni never did that. Very few times I've seen him do it. I remember once in IPL, after the game, he had said, there's little you can do if the bowlers don't bowl the right line. If you tell them to do something and they don't do it, there's little you can do. See, that was the most criticism I ever saw Dhoni give anybody. And that even to that, there wasn't an IPL game. So that, for me, is good management. And again, when he's, even when he's saying it, he's saying what the specific problem was, that he told them to bowl a certain length and they didn't. It's not Kohli making eyes and saying, bang, that's not helping anyone. That's just Kohli venting. And unfortunately, he has a manager who, rather than controlling that aspect of it, actually justifies it, saying, I want people to express themselves. Because Ravi Shastri himself was somewhat like that. So, you know, he has, unfortunately, he, rather than having somebody who controls those instincts, he has somebody who justifies those instincts. And that's exactly why he's there. Kumble was different and he got Kumble kicked out, which was, again, I will, you know, I love Kohli. I love his batting, but it's something which I'll never forgive as a fan. You know, getting Kohli out, but not just getting Kumble out, but the way he got Kumble out. I mean, Kumble of all people, you know, deserved much, much better than that. You know, it was not just Kumble, it was also Zahir Khan as a bowling coach, by the way. So it was a generation of cricketers who had unimpeachable credentials as being upright, honest, and very effective players. And it was not just one person, of a whole group of those people. So yeah, that's pretty much unforgivable. Anyway, so this was the episode for today. And I would like to hear your feedback. And whether you agree with, you know, with my interpretation of different captaincy styles and how they map to, you know, different kinds of leadership styles in the corporate world, and what have you seen? So feel free to write back, you know, email, WhatsApp. I would love to hear your substantial feedback on this. Thank you for listening.
Absolutely. This wasn't exactly the cricket podcast. A lot of MBA lessons as well right here. But that's pretty much our podcast for today. And if you haven't already, do listen and subscribe to What's Up Geeks. If you've I've told about this before, that's our tech podcast. It's a tech podcast without the tech. And Vinayak and I, we tell you about the news that matters. We have interviews, funda sessions, and recommend some really cool apps and games every episode. You can also visit our Amazon shop at amazon.in/shop/talkingstuff. That's amazon.in/shop/talkingstuff to buy all the stuff that we recommend. And that's us signing out for this week. So until next time, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.